We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short, and this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids. I'm Dr. Jane Gilmore, Honorary Consultant, Clinical Psychologist and Child Development Programme Director at UCL.
And I'm Omar Tassé, Professor of Psychology at the University of York, focusing on children and young people's mental health and special educational needs.
In each episode, we select a topic from the research literature. This episode is going to be a little bit different. Umar and I are going to explore an important topic and think about it with some depth and breadth that I think will be very interesting. At the end, we'll leave you with some takeaways for academics and practitioners. Today, we'll be discussing diagnoses and education in young people. This episode is called Special Educational Needs, to Label or Not to Label That. Is the question.
So we recorded this podcast on the week that it was announced that the education white paper, which was we were expecting to be released in the autumn, has been delayed until early 2026. So please just bear that in mind when you're listening to this episode.
So Umar, I am going to kick off and ask you this question. And I suspect you're going to have a lot to say about this. So perhaps you could lay out your ideas on diagnostic labelling.
Yeah, so I will start by saying I take an extreme view on this topic because I think sometimes someone needs to take an extreme view so that people then start to think about what we just accept as, I want to say normal, but you know, if we take an extreme view, then it gets people to question our existing practice. I think, well, why is he taking that extreme view? Even if I don't necessarily fully agree with the extreme view, I think it's important to communicate that. And then it gets people to think about it. So I'm going to put forward the case for we should scrap diagnostic labels altogether in education settings. So what do we mean by diagnostic labels? We have four groups of difficulties. So we have communication and interaction, which is things like speech, language and communication needs. The second one is cognition and learning. So that's things like dyslexia or specific learning difficulties. And then the third one is social, emotional and mental health difficulties. So we're familiar with those on this podcast, and it's things like emotional difficulties, behavioral difficulties. And then finally, we have sensory and physical needs, which are visual impairments. So those are the categories that the government and the SEND code of practice define and use to define difficulties that manifest in schools, but they don't necessarily neatly correspond to what we usually talk about. So we'll talk about depression, anxiety, ADHD, autism, etc., etc. So the question is, well, why do we have different categories for different contexts? Why don't we have a shared language? Why don't we have the same word for a group of difficulties that exist? And I would argue it's because the difficulties that exist and the way that we categorize them is not an inherent reality. It's not an innate reality. It's just different people using different phrases to categorize groups of difficulties as they exist in that context. And I would go as far as to say things like ADHD are behavioral manifestations of difficulty. That have developed over time when they present in clinical practice, so in your kind of practice. And over the years and decades, people are like, oh, I'm seeing these kids in practice, like this is what they are presenting with. And then you talk to someone else and you talk to someone else, and there's a consensus that these kids have ADHD. But actually, ADHD is not, for example, is not a coherent label. There are lots of subtypes, for example, and you could have two kids with ADHD who have different profiles. Go on, Jay.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I like your provocation, and I do. I think you have to take that position of extremity, as you say, to and so if you can't defend your position, if somebody comes in with an extreme, you know, tell me why this is from first principles, then your theory has no basis usually. What I did notice, and I think this is so important, is that shared language, and I think that is fundamental. And I think that comes, one of my questions would be that dismantling of the diagnostic system means we lose that shared language. Now, your point about different contexts having different language is a valid one, and I would take that. But I guess, so for example, the DSM system, and we'll come on to its imperfections in great detail, I'm sure, in a moment. But that's an internationally recognized language. And so it's almost a shorthand for a young person to say, this is the sort of challenges I have, maybe the positives that I've got to offer the world, and a large proportion of our global population would be able to recognize that. So caution with dismantling language. It's our, you know, shorthand, yes, imperfections, yes, but a communication strategy to allow a young person to be understood somewhat. Keep going. Yeah. This is fantastic.
I got it. So what I would take issue with there is having that universal language like you do in the DSM. What does that mean in education settings? So a child who is autistic, what does that tell us about their challenges and struggles within the education system? And actually, probably very little. Like, it doesn't tell us what they are specifically struggling with within an education setting. It might tell us that they have differences in social interaction that might impact on their communications at school. But actually, that will be different for different kids with different autistic kids. Similarly, ADHD, what does that tell us about what that child is struggling with at school? And there isn't a neat correspondence. And I think what I'm trying to argue for is if we can just scrap labels, even just in the education settings, and think about the child in front of us. So I don't, like, let's just put aside that this person has ADHD, this child has ADHD. Let's put aside that this child is autistic. What is it that they are struggling with at school in front of me? And then how can we support that child?
I mean, and look, that comes from a position of, you know, wanting to have a more nuanced provision for each individual child, which I think, you know, is definitely a positive. And I don't think there's anybody in our, in our context that would argue with that. But I guess if we go to a needs-led instead system, that would be a long list of needs probably for many young people. And there's no parsimony to that. You know, the concept should be somewhat a diagnosis, because if I have a list of 10 needs, which will probably be the case, you know, if we're thinking of the way that most of these conditions co-occur with other, you know, needs, then I've got a list of 10 needs that I have to carry with me. The other issue that I have with this, and you may be able to answer this very neatly, is the degree of conveyed need. Now, the horrors of DSM, and everyone agrees that dichotomous system is a blunt instrument, and it doesn't reflect either the empirical data nor what we see in front of us. But when a clinician makes that diagnosis, there is an implicit idea that there is impaired function. So this young person can't get access to their home and school, you know, activities because of autism or ADHD. So it's got a pragmatism in it. How would the needs-led system be delivered? You know, let's say I've got an attention need. Is it on a scale of 1 to 10, or is it, you know, major, minor? How would it convey to me as, you know, a clinician or a teacher or a, you know, parent what the degree of need is?
So I think that the first point that you make around, you know, you could have like 10 things that the child is struggling with or that we need to have a grapple with. But that is the nature of human beings. Like, you can't, I think my argument against labels is that we're reducing that level of complexity to a label. And actually, we have to accept that what we have is a child with a profile of strengths and challenges. And you might hear teachers or parents describe some of this as like spiky profiles. So, you know, you've got lots of stuff going on. You've got lots of strengths over here and some challenges over here and a bit of okay stuff over here. And that is the reality of lots of children and lots of human beings. And I think my thinking around this is that the world exists like that in a fluid, messy state. And what we try and do with labels is to put people into boxes. And that in itself is very difficult. Now, how would we support? So if we went away from this, how would we then support that diversity and those spiky profiles? And I think this is where this combination of universal approaches combined with targeted approaches comes in. So if we currently have an education system that works in a very specific way, and then children with special education needs fall out of that system. And then they were like, okay, so these children are struggling with education. Or learning and educational engagement. So they have a special educational need. Now let's try and target support towards them. But actually, what if we made the education system much more inclusive and accept that lots of children in a classroom, in a school, in this country will have a special educational need as the system is set up? And I think the statistic is something like, I think it's like 30 to 40%, I think, of children will have a special educational need at some point in their school career. So a large proportion of children will have a need. So then we should be designing the education system with that in mind. So things like, universal design for learning, for example. So acknowledging that there will be autistic kids in your classroom, there will be kids with ADHD, there will be kids with dyslexia, and it's not a minority. Lots of kids will have stuff. So then we design the curriculum, we design the assessments, we design the pedagogy in a way that is inclusive of those needs. And then fewer people will fall out of the system. So fewer people will need that special educational need. And then the ones that do, you can then target provision towards them. I think that So your second question, I was going to ask you a question. So I've been thinking about this. So the social model of disability suggests that special educational needs or neurodiversity or neurodevelopmental disorders, whatever you want to call it, is not inherently disabling. What's disabling is how society is set up. So if we can alter people's environments, then ADHD might not cause functional impairment, or autism might not cause functional impairment, and these kids will be able to access school in the same way as other kids who don't have those conditions. And I would agree with that. I would go further and say, if we think about if we consider what we know about gene environment interaction, so how genetic propensities interact with the environment when it comes to lots of needs, like cognitive functioning, for example, I would argue that the question is philosophical. Do these needs exist if there is no functional impairment? So if we change the environment and we make school more inclusive, and one of the criteria would be for a DSM diagnosis for some of these conditions would be functional impairment. Now, if there is no functional impairment because the environment has been changed, then does that child still have ADHD? Or is that child still autistic? Because there's no functional impairment. So like, what is, so then, and also there is no functional impairment, but also a lot of these conditions are behavioral. So like, It's like you have to show certain behaviors in certain contexts. But if we change society so those behaviors don't show and don't manifest and there isn't a functional impairment, then is that child still autistic?
Does it exist? I think increasingly this is going to be the debate of our time, because as we get better at identifying and measuring neurodiversity, as we have better access to treatment in some degree, I mean, we're far behind, as people start to identify their own level of need, the proportion of people who have, even if we use the old systems, who would fulfill criteria for a neurodevelopmental condition is getting larger and larger. And so the idea that neurodiversity will be the minority, I think, will be an old concept. But that is, of course, it's just the same way as biodiversity. I always say this, you need biodiversity for the planet to thrive. And in the same way, we need neurodiversity for society to thrive. And so the idea of having a different brain type or having a different approach to life, I think, will be left behind as, you know, a condition or a disorder. And I think that's part of our move, our general global shift to inclusion and acceptance and awareness of, you know, which I think is a positive thing. I think the issue is that, of course, there are continuum. So, you know, that young person who has a sensory issue and a social communication need, let's say, whose environment has shifted so that they aren't challenged day to day, but in certain situations will feel overwhelmed, or that young person who is at the far end of the continuum, and even if the environment is shifted, they still have struggles. Those young people will be left behind, I think, and won't be supported in a particular way. And I think it is a really significant challenge. Does that disorder exist? You know, it is a philosophical question. But I also, you know, I'm a real pragmatist and slightly utilitarian. And I think thinking about whether we shift philosophically and probably empirically and correctly, but how does that impact on young people who have a significant level of need, do they become, because presumably they will be the more extremely affected young people, will that somehow bring us back to the situation where you have kids with additional needs and they are separate and, you know, excluded? So it does feel like a philosophical question as well as an empirical one, as well as a clinical one.
I think that my other thing is around when we label, like, so let's just say that in a world where we've made all of these social adjustments and we've accommodated and we've designed learning for to be inclusive, and we've designed a world that's inclusive, there's no longer functional impairment and behavioral manifestations of these conditions don't happen, but we still agree that ADHD exists. Let's just assume that autism exists. Then the issue of at what point does normal invert, like,
typically developing, often maybe.
Like what? Yeah.
You know, is that a thing anymore? You know what?
It's
like a distribution, right? It's a distribution.
Exactly. So yeah, it's a normal distribution, and like there has to come a point where someone decides, or there's a clinical judgment, or there's a consensus that this is the point at which typical developing becomes abnormal. The problem is that changes. So a good example, in my view, is ADHD. So like in previous iteration of DSM, you had to have a certain combination of symptoms, but I think the age of onset was before the age of 7, I think it was. And now in the new version of the DSM, it's the age of 12. So there's a whole host of kids who wouldn't have, under the previous definition, had ADHD and now have ADHD. And so the point is that what is normal, what isn't abnormal, widens and changes. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, because I think that I do think that that commentary about ADHD is a great example. It's a really well selected one, that who fulfills criteria shifts depending on the social and cultural context. You know, think about I think it was DSM-3 was the edition in which homosexuality was removed as a psychiatric disorder. Now, the only thing that had changed is the cultural context, and that nothing else had. And so the DSM has certainly been very vulnerable to cultural and social shifts, but so has everything else. If you look at the literature, the empirical literature, I believe you could look at the trends in terms, and I mean that in the statistical sense, not the social sense, in terms of the series of data that's published on a particular topic, which allows us to stand on the shoulders of giants and get funding for a particular topic. And therefore, we become well-versed and explore that particular topic, right? And that is because we are a social group and we respond to one another. So I do think there are good examples of why DSM has fallen, and ADHD in the context of DSM is probably at the very intersection of the vulnerability. But I also think that everything has that context. You know, the language we use, you know, we've talked about cohort effects. I'll use a particular phrase and you'll use a different one. And that's what makes us, you know, human beings. It's a symptom of being a human being, I think.
I think it's interesting you've raised the point of homosexuality, because I think it'll help to make the point that I'm trying to make. It went from being a disorder to not being a disorder and something that society accepts, but there's still that group over there is gay. And then, but now we have an umbrella, so we have LGBTQ+. But actually, I think in the consensus, the accepted view in the scientific literature is that sexuality is a continuum. And actually, what we thought was the other, like what we thought was abnormal and gay, is not even that black and white. Like that other group of people doesn't exist. We are all on that continuum. And I think that I would argue that that also applies to all aspects of human functioning. So when we think about mental health, and I say this to my students in the first lecture that we do in child and adolescent mental health, is we need to be thinking about mental health not as those people over there have mental health difficulties and we don't. Everyone experiences some level of mental health difficulties at some point in their life, and it might be to a greater or lesser extent. It might be more severe or less severe than other people, but it is not that group of people over there who are experiencing mental health difficulties. And I would say we need to be thinking about neurodevelopmental conditions, special educational needs with the same lens. It is not those people over there who have ADHD, those people over there who are autistic, those people over there who have dyslexia or developmental.
But can we hold, because I think that's, I mean, I wouldn't argue with any of that, the idea that, you know, these features, for want of a better expression, are part of our society. They're there to a greater or lesser degree. And by using a diagnostic system where, you know, that's just forcing a nuanced profile into, an unnatural shape. Yes, and, you know, how the idea that we have no parsimony in that description is important, but we can have that position and that understanding. So for example, I could use a list of different words that try and get across how I'm feeling right now. And then I might have to choose one to say, right now, I am feeling this. So I have to pull together, while I'm understanding that there's nuance in my emotional temperature and I feel to a greater or lesser degree this, I have to choose a word to stand for how I feel. And I think that's okay. I can understand the nuance behind that, and I can understand there's more to be, it's almost like the diagnosis is a hypothesis. I need to think about what the needs would be behind that. And that's almost like a position, a societal position, which I think we are moving towards. I don't think we're there yet. And you can still have a word that stands for something. It's a bit like, we talk about culture quite a lot, and I think there's a really good kind of equivalent there. So, we talked at the beginning, and I'm a Scottish person, right? There's some things that might sit with that stereotype. Some of them probably are true, and others will not be. So if we would talk about bullying, it brings out the Glaswegian in me, and I become very passionate. But, I am more than somebody who's just Scottish. So those cultural labels that can sometimes be used in a very warm way, not just a negatively stereotyped way, but also we also understand that I'm more than just a Scottish person. So that, this is not that. So I don't know why can't we have both? I want it all, Umar. I want the value of the communication that I think diagnosis brings in the shorthand way, understanding it's imperfect. And I want that positioning that you're talking about in terms of knowing that every individual is different. And these features are within us all to a greater or lesser extent.
Okay. So I'm going to take you on a journey.
I'm ready.
So it was like, I'm going to answer that question. So in, 2022, so I saw this paper in the JCPP, and it was the annual research review by Duncan Assel, and I think, what was it called? It was called The Transdiagnostic Revolution in Neurodevelopmental Disorders. And what they report in that review, or what they try and describe, is that lots of diagnostic labels like ADHD, developmental language disorder, have common cognitive processing difficulties, for example, or phonological processing difficulties. And actually, what's common across these conditions, there's a lot of things, and the labels don't describe the difficulties. So from that, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. So the labels that we use to describe people's profiles don't accurately capture their strengths and challenges. So like you, I was like, okay, so the label, maybe we just need a better label, because labels are helpful. So how about we think about, how about we accept that these labels need to exist, because we need a shorthand to describe someone's profile and have that shared language. But the ones that we have aren't perfect and aren't great at doing that. And these are all the reasons why they're not. So let's try a different way. So what we did was, at the beginning of this conversation, I talked about consensus. So I said, labels like ADHD would have come from children presenting in clinical practice, and then lots of experts going, oh, I'm seeing these children as well. And then there'd been a consensus about, like, this is what ADHD is. And I would say that's a human-driven approach informed by data. Now, I wanted to flip that on its head and be like, well, how about we do a data-driven approach informed by humans? So let's get all of these underlying strengths and challenges, irrespective of their labels. So let's think about cognitive functioning. Let's think about language. Let's think about social functioning, anxiety, depression symptoms, conduct problems, et cetera, et cetera. Don't think about the label. Just think about what the strengths and challenges are. And then do some data-driven analysis. So put these into some statistical models and see what the data says. What does the data tell us? What do the models tell us around how these things cluster? Because then what we'll have is not human beings saying, oh, this combination of things is ADHD, but the computer saying, well, this combination of things seems to cluster together. Population. And that's what we did. And we're about halfway through that work. And what we're finding is the data-driven diagnostic labels that we were like, let's try and find a different way to describe people's children's strengths and challenges. They're just a different set of labels. They don't map onto autism. They don't map onto ADHD. The kinds of things that we come up with are, 10% of children in primary school will have reading difficulties with behavioral problems. And the other 3% will have difficulties across the board on social and emotional functioning. And then there's this small group over here who'll have some depression symptoms, nothing else. And it doesn't map on to anything that we recognize. So then my point there is, we had this human-driven, data-informed approach, which kind of is what the DSM, I would say, is. Then we've got this data-driven approach that we tried, and we just get a whole different set of labels, which probably, and we haven't tested this yet, but probably are equally imperfect. They have their own challenges. So my view is, it doesn't matter how you slice the cake, you're always going to have imperfection. And you're always going to have imperfection in how we describe children's strengths and challenges. So then my answer to that is, let's just be done with them in school. With them, like, whatever you come up with is going to be imperfect.
I think it really reminds me of a time when I did a school visit, and it was just when the phrase special needs had been sort of developed and introduced to provision systems, let's say. Now, there'd been a series of other labels that had been used in the past, and these were obviously pejorative, and special needs was the phrase that the preferred phrase. I walked across a playground to see a young person, and of course it was a young person who was being identified, but a bunch of kids shouted at this identified child, special needs. So in other words, instead of saying a pejorative word, it was, they used the word of the moment. That was, there was no argument with that, but the point is, it was conveyed in a pejorative way. So I think your point is, it doesn't matter what the label is, the point is they can be misused. But I want to come back to the idea of humanity. You know, you said, you know, human beings versus data. I'm data schmater. I mean, you know, I do love my evidence, but let's think about the humanity. Because I do think the idea of a diagnosis has some pros that are inherently human in their utility. So if we think particularly about young teenagers, and I do lots of work with young teenagers, and one of their tasks, their developmental tasks, is to form an identity. Yep. And if we take a needs-led approach, we have that list of 10 needs, let's say, that there's, you know, they're dragging around. That can't be, that's harder to assimilate into their identity formation, because I think, and the reason I'm saying this, I'm not suggesting that this should be an overwhelming part of identity, and I'll come to that in a second, but my persistent and consistent experience that if a diagnosis is delivered in a positive way, that young person and their family often think and convey this emotionally. Oh, that's why. Oh, now I understand. And it's such an empowering sense of, got such explanatory power that is really powerful. The other thing that related to this is that kind of sense of belonging that's particularly important for teenagers. You know, teenagers need to find their tribe. And in this way, they often find their neurotribe in a way that a list of, you know, needs can never touch. It moves away from that deficit model and allows that young person to be understood. Having said that, I also know with that identity issue that young people, as part of their typical process, will potentially over-identify or completely reject an identity. So we'll vacillate between the two. So let's say I have ADHD. ADHD explains everything I've ever done, said, or thought. So the reason I didn't get invited to that party is because I have ADHD. So it closes down curiosity, and that's not a positive. Or the young person, or sometimes that same young person can say, do you know what? I don't want to have ADHD. I'm going to try out the neurotypical coat and see how it fits. And so I'm not going to tell anyone in my new education system, typically college, that I have ADHD, and I'm not going to take my medication if they're, you know, that's implied. And that, you know, that might work for them, but it also might put them in a situation where they're peddling so hard to appear neurotypical that, you know, it can be, you know, have impact. So I think the idea that a label can be particularly for those in the teenage phase of life, can be something that's very powerful. But we've also got to be aware of that vacillation. I think the other thing, and we're going to talk just very briefly, I think, about EHCP and the potential shakeup that might be there, is as things stand, that diagnosis is one of the few things that will move an EHCP forward. It unlocks resources and understanding. So let's think about the EHCP. What are your thoughts on that? And I'll tell you what mine are in a moment.
So EHCP is educational healthcare plans.
Thank you.
Before I go on to that, can
let's
I...
not use that label. Let's unpack that and go knee. Heaven forfend.
Can I just pick up on something you said just now, which is all of what you're saying, I can see, I understand where you're coming from. I think my concern is if we carry on down this road of diagnostic labels, we talk about diagnosis, like diagnostic labels, it comes from this, like the whole concept of diagnosis, in my understanding, comes from this medical model approach. And I think the problem with that is you situate the problem within the individual. So you're saying to a child, you are struggling with this because you have ADHD. Now, we might then caveat that with, oh, well, you know, that's a social model of disability. But to a child, they are struggling because they have ADHD. There's something wrong with them inside them.
You see, I think, no. I just won't take that. No. This is about the delivery. Some of the things you've told me about today, they are sometimes described as, so I talk about behaviors. It's a little bit like expressed emotion. So if I say, you are lazy, that's a hostile comment. That's embedding that in that person. But I might say, the way you did that today, was a bit of a challenge in terms of speed. See, I'm fettling very hard there. But you can see I'm talking about the behavior there that maybe we need to pick up the pace. So if I say you've got ADHD and that's a problem for me in the way that I'm messaging that, or even if I say to that person, I'm so sorry to tell you, the doctors have looked at all the questions that you and your family have answered, and I'm sorry, but you have ADHD. There is a message in there, you've got the problem, that is a problem. Instead of saying, the things you told me can be described in this way. And one of the things we can do is use that to think about how we can change things at home and at school. So I know what you're saying, but I would argue that the delivery is absolutely fundamental. And I think our shift in society is catching up with that delivery. It's not you, it's the behavior that you are showing, which I think your data, I think having read that very, very good paper, Mark, which you sent me, that data-led approach does support. You know, things will change and it will shift, but it's behavior-led rather than, what's the word, you know, person-centered, if that's right,
yeah,
to differentiate.
I think so, yeah. I think my ongoing concern would be, or ongoing question would be, irrespective of how it's delivered, irrespective of you as a clinician and your excellent communication and delivery skills with the child, what does that child actually internalize going away from that consultation then in their everyday life in a school or in their interactions with their peers? And I think that's the bit that I'm more concerned about, but we don't know.
I'll take that because I think it is a label can be can be powerful and empowering, or it can be pejorative. And I think that can work both ways. I'll absolutely take that very carefully. Yeah, good point.
EHCP, so educational healthcare plan. So this is children who have a special educational need been identified in schools, but their needs can't be met by existing provision, and there needs to be additional support put in place. So then there's if I'm not wrong, it's a legally binding document which sets out the legal rights of the child in terms of support. And then there's a statutory requirement, and I think there's some additional funding attached to it, which is why it's now become a problem for the government, because lots more children are getting an EHCP.
Well, in 2019, 295,000 EHCPs were issued. In 2023, shall we guess? Do you want to guess how high?
Oh.
How high should we go? 195,000 in 2019.
Oh, so this is your putting my math skills to the test. Do the maths with you. So in 2014 to 2024, I think there was a 90% increase, if I remember those numbers. So from 2019 to 2024, I would say, are you up to like 400,000?
Yeah, I'm very impressed. You win. 435,000. In 2023.
Yeah.
So it does, your question about whether it's philosophical, empirical or financial, I think is pertinent.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that we go back to that question. If we accommodate these children's needs, then what can we reduce the reliance on EHCPs? Because EHCPs is your needs can't be met by existing provision. But if we amend and adjust existing provision universally, then more kids' needs would be met by existing provision. Therefore, the need and the reliance on EHCPs, people would need them less. Now, I my understanding.
But wait a minute, surely your thesis is, you know, each individual child has a portfolio of need. So actually a specific EHCP for each individual child that has a level of need, does that not imply, because if the environment is generically positive, yes, absolutely, but children have different spiky profiles. So the environment can't be the same for each child.
It can't, but what I'm arguing is that the current system is set up for a very specific group of children who excel academically, and we try and push everyone into that path of doing things. And actually, if we set the system up so it wasn't just targeted at that narrow group of children, then more people's needs would be accommodated within that. So therefore, there'd be less need for those. So you'd have fewer children falling out of the system because the system wouldn't be as narrow. I think the argument around EHCP, so we'll see when the white paper and the school's white paper comes out, but I think it's all speculation. Like, so we don't know what's going to be in the white paper, but there was some suggestion earlier in the summer that EHCPs were going to be scrapped, and there was lots of uproar and protest against that, because those were the legal protections that those vulnerable children were granted. The government seems to have gone quiet on that.
Mm. So
they quietly drop, or it was never being considered seriously, and like then it just became a thing. We don't know what happened, but in any case, my view is that if even when it was a possibility that was seriously being considered, and allegedly we don't know, I would argue that actually the way forward would be to reduce reliance on EHCP by making the system more inclusive rather than scrapping them. And then that's a longer term strategy, rather than from next year, we're no longer going to have these.
Mm. I mean, look, a rising tide lifts all boats. So if we improve the environment, the likelihood is, and the truth is that any teaching process, let's say, for a young person who's got an additional need will benefit all young people. So if I, unpick, let's say, analogies or for a young person who's got autism, that improves everybody's English language understanding. If I use novelty, sometimes say to teachers, use novelty, get the kids to turn around and face the other way in the classroom and teach from the back, just switch it up. That's great for every kid, and the kid with an ADHD-like profile will engage better. But my problem, I think, with EHCPs is partly the way they're written. I get involved in doing these and I read a lot of these, and very often they're so badly written that actually they've become meaningless. So, when the additional provision is described, you need to be really specific about what, who, when, and how much provision is required. So access to additional social communication support means absolutely nothing. I want to know who's giving it. I want to know what that is. And I want to know how often it's given and where it's given. And so you have to find your inner pedant when you're writing an EHCP. I also think the other issue is that they should be embedded in different subjects. So, a science lab is very different from, the history classroom. And the needs that a different child will have will be very different depending on that. And that very often is not delivered. I also would pick some priorities. I pick my top three. And make those the changes rather than a list of 10, because they get lost otherwise. Mm-hmm. But look, I think it's interesting that it has gone quiet, because I did read the press and you sent, I think you sent an article. I found an article. I can't remember which one it was. Apologies, Umar, if you sent me it. You're talking about, the rumor that it might disappear. So that white paper may appear, it may not. But in any case, we can still improve. And maybe this is my thesis, we can improve our use of the existing system, whether it's EHCP or not. Shall we think about our takeaways? What's your deliverable on this front? It's a really, there's a lot here. There's a philosophical stance. There's an empirical issue. What's your takeaway from an academic point of view?
I would say from an academic point of view, and I don't think this is new for anyone in the academic sphere anymore, which is we need to be thinking about children's strengths and challenges, even in research studies, beyond labels. Like, it's really easy as a researcher to be like, oh, I want to investigate the difference between autistic and neurotypical young people, because those data sets exist, those variables exist, I'm going to do that. But actually, what does that tell us about the population that you're trying to investigate? We don't know. So rather than thinking about what's the difference between autistic and neurotypical, what's the difference between autistic and ADHD children, it's thinking about their broad difficulties in this trans-diagnostic way, or those challenges as well as difficulties. So moving away from this diagnostic labeled focused research projects. But we all do it. We all do it because it's easier to do that. But we need to just challenge ourselves. And I do it as well. So I'm not saying I'm not judging people. I'm like, I do it too. Like, and with dissertation projects, I'll suggest that are like autistic and neurotypical populations. So over to you, Jane.
Well, look, I think you argue I think you argue a very good point, and I absolutely accept theoretically and empirically, you know, I think there are major flaws in the current system. And I also argue, yes, and that for the young people and children and families that are on the receiving end of these labels, if, and it's a big if, I grant you, they're delivered optimistically and realistically, find real therapeutic value in these labels. So at the beginning, we said to label or not to label. That's the question. And I would say that's my answer.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Jane. I really enjoyed that conversation. And it's nice because, like, you really talk to somebody who doesn't, maybe, I don't know what your view was coming into this, but it was nice that you acknowledged, challenged in a respectful way, and then we're like, okay, let's think about this. So it was really nice. So thank you.
Yeah, no, it was good. I really enjoyed that. I think we should do more of these. And because, well, you know, because apart from anything, it's so good because this is at the heart of, you know, I did this data and it made me think theoretically like this. And I say, well, here's how, you know, the take from a clinical point of view, because it really is, because, you know, because theoretically and empirically, yes, you know, there is no debate. The question is, you know, in the as they say, the real world. I hate that expression. It's, you know, as opposed to the unreal world. But yeah, that was good. Enjoyed that.
Well, I really hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as we did, and specifically I did. I love talking about this stuff. So if you enjoyed it as much as we did, please leave a review or a comment, and also share with your friends and colleagues, and subscribe to our page.